Hi everyone, everyone's still awake?
Yeah.
I'm one of those people who used to use Prezi all the time, and then I got a proper job. And my writing practices had to be commensurate with my employment, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at, because lots of people use PowerPoint in university. So I'm going to talk about the methods. Somebody called me Methods Man the other day. Just here, actually. Earlier, they called me Methods Man, and I've got sucked into this whole methods vortex. I didn't intend to, but it's just happened. The methods are important and interesting. We wanted to dedicate a session to it because people want to replicate and do similar kinds of research elsewhere, and we hadn't seen a project that does the same kind of thing in the same way that we have done. So one of the things that we found was that since the emergence and significance of the digital in contemporary life, researchers, quantitative and qualitative researchers of various kinds have tried to capture that social life, and that's become a bit of a methodological challenge. So we approach that challenge from the perspective of researching writing in higher education. New digital practices to aid and facilitate writing pose a new set of demands on research methods when you want to capture those forms of writing. And this necessitates some kind of methodological innovation. This wasn't very easily achieved, and it came with its own sets of challenges. Just a quick reminder on the theoretical perspective before I go into the methods. We're using literacy studies, which handles literacy as a set of practices, social practices that have histories, they have cultural norms attached to them, they are a part of social practices in society, they have values attached to them, they're not individual isolating sort of skills that you can say are literacy skills, they're more than that. And we also adopt a socio-material perspective where we see writing as something that emerges through an entanglement of people and things. It's not just people, it's the things, the algorithms, the softwares, the shape and design of the rooms and the buildings even. They shape a certain kind of writing culture, a certain choreography of writing sometimes in the life of the individual academic. So we saw this slide earlier, but it's just an overview of the three phases of the research. So phase one was working with individuals. These were our focal participants. We did three kinds of interviews with each participant. A walk-around interview, a technobiographic interview, and a day-in-the-life interview, and I'll talk about those. We did in-situ recordings of the writing processes using a screening method. I'll talk about each of these methods in more detail. So we took a situational encounter, a writing event, an examiner's report, or a report of some kind, or a paper being written, or a review of a paper, or anything, and we recorded the entire thing using a screen-in-screen method. And then we sort of broadened the inquiry to go still within the orbit of the focal participants, but looking at their heads of departments, their admin colleagues, and their academic colleagues, and getting their take on the academic writing culture in said department or discipline. So, phase one. We've seen excerpts of the interviews. We haven't told you which one it was when we gave that excerpt, but the first one was a walk-around interview. This was fun. It was holding a recorder and walking around with the participant, or recording them whilst we were seated and then walking around with them, because if other participants come into the situation as they say hello and open and close doors, and there's ethical issues there. So sometimes we didn't do it like that. We walked around the department and talking to the participants about the culture of the department, where they sit and work, where they sit and talk, the photocopying room, the room where they produce writing, but the room or where they shred their writing. So destruction of text is as important as production of text, and people invest a lot in shredders. So there's this whole sort of production and destruction thing. So walking around and getting a sense of the culture of that particular corner of the campus in which they work and how that influences their writing. That was followed later by a technobio interview. Now this is a kind of interview where you talk about the participants' history of writing practices, their habits of use over time, their how they started to learn academic writing when they were a student, and how that changed and evolved into when they started their career and now, and their aspirations and hopes, and a different dimension to their subjectivity that you would then otherwise obtain. And then we did a day in the life interview where we go through their diary and we take a day or a couple of days and go through every single piece of writing that they've done, be it informal or personal or whatever, in that day. And so what we get are, each discussion yields a different point of view, point of focus within the data, and a different dimension to the interviewee's subjectivity. Repeated interviews were necessary to avoid a kind of snapshot account of the participants' writing and their lives. It needed multiple interviews, differently focused ones, and done over time with other methods, as we'll get to. And each interview allowed us to seek clarification or additional information about the issues raised in the early interviews, and we saw some of that conflicted stance talked about by David earlier. So phase two it was of slightly more using a videography, where we've honed in on a certain particular situation, a particular participant, a particular moment in their working life, based on what we heard from the interviews. Now this is Don, a historian, and he said in an earlier interview, he said, I do all my research writing at home, so you can come home and monitor me and record me, I'll do my non-research writing at work, so you can come here. So I decided to see him at work, and this used a screen-in-screen method. Forgive me for citing myself, but I invented the term screen-in-screen, I think. And I've written quite detailed accounts of using that method for literacy and writing research already, so you can look at that if you're interested in using that method elsewhere. So this allowed us to look at this was a screen recording ongoing alongside an angled webcam view of the participant, where we get to see how they've arranged their sort of table and their office, and we can see interruptions occurring throughout the writing session. We get to see things like environmental sort of arrangement of office tools, screen arrangement habits. I mean, Don here, as a default setting for some reason, has his email always open. That's why I've blurred it out so you can't see it. But he has, it's almost like a default screen setting. So the environmental setting isn't just the table and the room and the shelves. It's the screen arrangement is a kind of environmental setting. And interruptions from people and colleagues and students, capricious web searches and diversions, and other acts during writing are sometimes part of the act of writing. And that's what we got there. So then, these were then rendered into video logs, and we're going to see an example of a recording, and we're going to look at it and try to see what we can get from that. And then the recordings were then rendered into logs, where we got sort of minute by minute description of salient moments in the actual writing activity. And then we honed in on certain moments and tried to sort of theorise them a bit more in light of the research questions. So I just want to pause here and talk about what does it mean to be innovative. Lots of people said in relation to this phase of the methodology, oh, that's innovative, that's different. And it comes with its own specific set of challenges. Researchers in academia are often encouraged to be innovative in our methodological approaches. It's considered to be of benefit in environments where research is won through funding, and a competitive sort of a situation. A novel or innovative methodology can be argued to offer new ways of carrying out research and contribute substantially to impact. And new ways of carrying out research, new methods, can yield new forms of impact. So for us, being innovative here meant adapting existing methods from other disciplines, video analysis, video ethnography, ethnomethodology, etc. But also it was innovative in the sense that it was studying a new area of social life, or to provide insight into that social life which is difficult to access by traditional methods, therefore filling what some people call a methods gap. And it's on this basis that we felt we needed this kind of methodology. For us, it was about providing insight into a specific aspect of academic professional life that is difficult to access via other traditional methods. So that was the rationale behind the importance of the phase two part. Like other researchers trying to capture elements of the new social digital world, like those who use data analytics, for example, We wanted access to the ecological processes of writing as it's actually happening. The actors, not just the humans who knock on the doors, who write the emails, but also the software updates that, and the notifications and the documents and policies that the academics are using and appropriating that are influencing the choreography of writing in the moment. They are also part of the kind of thing we wanted to capture. These actors also need to be part of the ethnographic critical lens. So we're going to look at a segment of the phase two extract now. And this is Robert Bennett, who's a mathematician. And he just got back from Barcelona, where he... How do I capture that? Where he had a meeting with... let's see my notes. So he had a meeting with lots of different other academics around the world. And an output from the meeting was that he has to publish abstracts of some of his talks. So he needs to convert two talks given at the meeting into two four-page articles for a new volume that he's agreed with his team that he met in Barcelona. And he begins this process in this particular recorded session. So I've forwarded it to 2 minutes, and then we can just watch it. I don't know if you can get it there. There we go. He sort of kindly allowed us to use it. You might not be able to read the details of it. He's using LaTeX. Do you know what that is? And does anyone not know what it is?
No.
Does anyone who knows what it is want to explain to those who don't so I can actually know?
It's a program that's used extensively by mathematicians and other scientists, which enables a much better representation of mathematical text than word processing does, but it involves essentially writing a program to produce a text. So what you can see there is a program that's been written that is then compiled into a textual form. So it's a little bit like HTML if you've written websites at all in the olden days, when you used to be able to do that easily.
He writes so much prolifically, and he sits on a tiny desk about this size, and he sits like, and he just types. He's got a huge room and he just sits there and does all his work. It's crazy. Anyway, can you hear? You don't necessarily have to hear, actually, but I'll... Hold on. I'll put the sound up on you. Okay. Well, you don't need to hear it anyway, because he didn't say much.
So the method is he does not explain to you what he's doing, he's just doing it, right?
Yeah, he's just doing it. I mean, there are... We did ask the participants to talk through some things.
Mm-hmm.
But he's actually just... What he's doing is he's selecting entirely something that he wrote previously, and he's going to copy it, and he's going to paste it into a new file that he's going to work from using LaTeX. And he's doing that because LaTeX is a program, and contained within the text are hidden instructions to repeat the format, a relied upon format, established practices from the past, held together, transposed into the new file. Okay? So he doesn't have to do it all from scratch. Well, that's an interesting word, from scratch. What writing is from scratch? So it's a very quick workaround that many people probably do. In my previous work on assignment writing, I saw that students would use previous assignments, the font, the validation, the page set, previously successful pieces of work, just by their format would be a basis upon which to bring commence new text. So what we get to see here are... Yeah, he's doing a lot of that. For a few minutes. What we get to see here are how metalogistical strategies work in order to do the work. Shadow work, as some people call it. From well-archived... From well-archived previous work that is well-archived on pen drives and folders and things like that, mobilised into action... To get a head start on current writing, Multiple applications are also running on screen at the same time. These are his previous folders that he mobilizes to commence new writing very, very quickly. He also talks in this session about time management strategies. If you did as much as you could, you would be there forever, he says, during this particular writing strategy. And he also talks, he also spends a lot of time pondering and thinking mid-sentence, thinking about what he wants to write. And later on in this recording, we get to see interruptions from students and also about the setup, you know, and how students can sit inside his office and do things as he's writing sometimes. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on here. And this is a small laptop that he's using, but that's half of that screen. And he, at some point, he clicks something which then shows him what that would look like in its final form, as a PDF, like a print preview, okay, in its beautiful font typeset sort of version. Okay, I'll just stop that. And so that kind of thing was then, just going to here. Okay, good. So that was then rendered into video logs, okay, where it's not really a transcription per se, it's just a log of a detailed log of everything that he did. And you get to see that there. So then that sort of broke it down for us to analyse in more detail. Okay, and that's another one there. So, what did we find for this particular phase of the research? Well, I'm not going to go into detail, but I guess it's a kind of finding that some people didn't want to be recorded. Now, in qualitative research, when people don't want to be researched, that's worthy of inquiry, isn't it? Why don't they want to be researched? So, some people felt that this kind of methodology, reflecting on it, was a little bit invasive, even if it is unobtrusive. And so I said, we're not recording my screen, and even though we gave them the option to pause and to, if they wanted to do anything else on the screen, they don't want to see, and stuff like that. So, but no, some people said, so we had to create another way of creating the video log, which was through sort of a Think Aloud protocol method with a physical institute observer at the time instead. But that was on one or two occasions. Most people were okay about being recorded. But still, if we are critically reflecting on our methodology, we have to reflect on why some people didn't want to be recorded. So that's important. So we found that people set up their environments in different ways, and that this is salient to their writing. It hasn't been picked up on very much in a lot of writing research, but we felt that it was. It highlights the physicality, or we found that it highlights the importance of the physicality, the resources, the material, and the mundane things like the coffee and things like that. As part of the ritual of writing. There's so many interruptions, human and non-human, people obviously, but also notifications and emails and updates and pings and bleeps of one form or another continuously. There's very little uninterrupted time. Somebody mentioned earlier about the translocal spaces or something, like the interstitial spaces, like the plane or the train, where you're less likely to get these interruptions. That's an interesting place because you're less likely to get them. It's more likely to be uninterrupted. There's a lot of time searching. Some people, but also email is a kind of repository where people locate a document. They'll go to their email to locate the document instead of what we would think, Dropbox or folder, which are meant for storing documents. It made me think about how some texts are attached to other texts, because if someone says, I sent you that email, or I sent you that document, well, I know that that document was sent in an email which will contextualize that document. So there's a text connected to another text, connected to another text, and sometimes our minds work like that. So a lot of the time participants were finding documents through emails rather than storing them in folders, as we turn ahead. The nods in the room sort of suggest that other people do that as well. The rapid and cyclical nature of texts. You see how quickly he began that text and got a head start because he used the previous text. In Don's, in the screenshot I showed you earlier of Don, he was doing an examiner report. He no sooner had he completed that report that he got an email asking to be an examiner for another PhD, and he asked him how many he had done, and I think he did 8 or something, and he then put, I'd done 9, because he put the one that he'd just done when he got the email, which is a bit quick, but the cyclical nature of, I'm moving on, you know, I'm really moving on, I've done 9 now, and it was like really quick, and so the speed of it all. One of my favourite books is Goffman's first monograph on asylums, and he has a chapter on the underlife of the asylum. I'm not taking the analogy any further than that. But the academic institution, there is a value system imposed on the academic, and Goffman says that there are many value systems in an institution. There's a value system imposed on the subject, but sometimes the subject assumes a different value system, a different identity that is set apart from the one imposed on them, and he calls those practices the practices of the underlife. And I think this kind of methodology, as well as the other things we've seen, capture elements of the underlife. You might want to, sort of, might be food for discussion later. So I think that's one of the things we've found. So we've talked a little bit about method. It's a repeat slide. Yeah, here we are. So there are ethical and practical issues, and these must be reflected on, especially if you're using, quote, innovative methods. Questions posed by the institutional process of ethical review were not specific enough to address what we faced. We faced slightly different things. For example, other people brought into the writing tasks, co-writers, emails, you don't know who's going to copy, you can't, you know, diary entries. These are all these issues raised up. All these things raise issues about the core ethical aspects of consent, confidentiality, and anonymity. And there are others who have written about that, about can generic principles, can ethical challenges, especially that research that adopts digital technologies to monitor or to research digital activities, can that be resolved through generic ethical principles? And I think that we can contribute to that discussion. And what are the key issues that we need to engage in to research the digital university, whether you're looking at analytics like you are or you're doing more qualitative research? I think that there are, in terms of methods, the new sort of digital landscape has led to various forms of distributed working, new forms of working. And the contemporary academic workforce includes many people who move between sites during the course of a working day, switch between different kinds of communication, personal social networks, as well as their professional ones, and there's a conflation of all these things. So all these things bring methodological implications. So what kinds of methods can we employ, what kinds of observational techniques, and how can we best undertake them is an important question to ask. And there is often a tension between research ethics and innovation. And they apply to qual and quant, as I've said. We didn't do a full-on institutional ethnography, but a university is a public institution, so what we produce has to be publicly made available. So we've got to sort of like disseminate that. But critical reflection is still necessary with any type of new method. In order for qualitative research to remain inventive and authoritative. Right, so now phase 3, just bear with me. Staying within the orbit of the focal participant. just one more point about that. We were looking at one participant, but other people got involved. We were looking at one context, work, but personal life got involved. We were looking at one text, but lots of different texts got involved in that one text. So this idea that of the situational kind of research is, when you use these kinds of methods, you get a lot of scattered sort of findings that go beyond the sort of situational research. So that's something to reflect on. So anyway, phase 3. Moving on from the focal participants, staying within their orbit, we spoke to heads of departments. We spoke to admin colleagues, team leaders, and people like that, and these people brought broader insights into the departmental and disciplinary writing culture that is vital to our findings. For example, one head of department said that I treat my academic workforce or colleagues who are under my management as consultants. So I just see them as consultants in all but name. You might have a comment on that. But I mean, that kind of insight is very important. So we have to go to other people. Another example is the experiences that the admin staff face is in relation to our academic work is fascinating. I'll just let you read that. And there's another one there. So, Holly, admin workers have to combat different kinds of pressures in relation to the same work that academics are doing. Examples of 6 inboxes for emails, moving around the campus a lot, and shared office, not just with 1 or 2 people, but sometimes with 8 people, as she was saying. And so that's a different kind of insight that's very important for for our research. And Holly has an academic identity because she's upset about loss of an academic-related contract a few years ago, and is now in an admin role, which has a different set of cultural and writing-related challenges to it. And so, yeah, the insights from academic colleagues is really important in the research. And so, yeah, that's it. I'm just 5 minutes before time. Mm-hmm.